Good evening. It's a great pleasure to be here tonight to take part in this debate. I should start by setting out my political philosophy. I'm a Member of Parliament for the New Zealand National Party. The National Party includes people with a wide range of views. It's a Liberal Conservative Party, as it mixes people from both the Liberal and Conservative political traditions. The Labour Party often calls itself a broad church, although with respect I think they're more homogenous these days. The National Party has always encompassed a wide range of viewpoints, and I think the National Party is the broad church of New Zealand politics. At times, differences between Liberals, Conservatives and those in between have caused problems for the party, but I think that its success has rested and still rests on the successful interaction between the Liberal and the Conservative branches. I can recall years ago people attending conferences, for example, in Rotorua, where delegates from Wellington Central would turn up. Some would sign the pro-abortion petition or the gay rights petition outside the conference, while others would be members of the Society for the Protection of the Unborn Child. So the National Party can accommodate both extremes. So as far as I can define myself, I'm probably a classical or Gladstonian liberal, although I've always liked Disraeli more than Gladstone. I found Gladstone a rather odd character. The tenets of economic liberalism are limited government expenditure, low taxation, and balanced budgets. It emphasises free trade, less government intervention in the economy, and equality of opportunity through institutional reform. I thought it would be useful to set this out before I began, because these are philosophical matters, and quite apart from being a liberal, I'm also a Roman Catholic, although I do have a great respect and affection for the other great peoples of the book, and I especially have affection for Judaism. I strongly believe that John Paul II was right when he said that anyone who is anti-Semitic is anti-Christian, as they are ripping up the roots of the church. And I think it would be good if some in my church listened to what John Paul had said. The topic of tonight's discussion is how do our religious traditions inform economic policy? Now, the response of many would be to say that they hope religious traditions don't inform economic policy at all. James Madison, the fourth president of the United States, said that religion and government both exist in greater purity the less they are mixed together. The principle of separation of church and state, of course, is well established, at least in this country. But it's simplistic to exclude our religious traditions from our consideration of the economic system. New Zealand is the heir, or one of the heirs, to Judeo-Christian traditions. It is a country with a Judeo-Christian heritage. The ancestors of that heritage include the scribes and prophets of the Old Testament: Moses, Joshua, Job, Solomon, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and Daniel. As Jim Trowey so elegantly put it in his essay, Ancestors of the Mind, the Pākehā Whakapapa, these were men who sought a meaning in history and who believed that humanity had enough of the divine to uncover the secrets of God's creation. It is that heritage that has helped form New Zealand, and it's that heritage that still underpins our system of government, our economics, and the way our society functions. So just because church and state are separate estates does not mean that we should rush to ignore the continuing influence of the one on the other. So how does religion inform the modern economic system? I think there's sometimes an unfortunate tendency among some to equate Christianity with ideas of social democracy. Many see the Bible's focus as the group rather than the individual. Part of this is because of the organized and communal nature of religion. Of course, we work in groups, such as churches and congregations, And in doing so, we can achieve many things together. But there's a fundamental difference between voluntary and limited purpose groups like churches and the state with its coercive power. Let us not forget that the Ten Commandments are set out to us as individuals, not some kind of obligation to be transferred to the state. Christian responsibilities are personal responsibilities. I recently saw an article which argued that capitalism fosters the decline of virtue because of a faulty understanding of human nature and its limited vision of the good. I think the arguments marshalled by those who thinks Christianity requires us to be social democrats lacks vigour. There is a strong counter-argument to be made, especially in economic policy. The Christian tradition is an economically liberal tradition. It's no surprise that a central plank of communism was destroying religion. Private property has a scriptural base. The Bible explicitly prohibits theft, fraud, moving property barriers, debasing money, violating contracts, as well as coveting. These prohibitions apply to both citizens and the rulers. Yet some people claim that the Bible, especially in the Old Testament passages, preaches a form of socialism or even communism. We hear a lot about greed from these people. There seems to be an idea that profit is inherently unjust. Profit is the reward entrepreneurs receive for more successfully producing what people want. Entrepreneurs live by identifying other people's needs and wants and satisfying them. If you want to help others, the price mechanism tells you what they want. If you don't use price mechanism as your guide, you are simply risking imposing your priorities onto other people. Attempts to help people by state interference with the price mechanism are often misconceived, as they can cause distortions of effort by others. An example is the cheap food policies in African countries, which have resulted in agriculture failing and people who would have been growing crops heading into town to join food queues. So often fair trade policies can be misconceived as they send misleading signals to producers. The reason commodity prices fall is overproduction, and so the correct response is to produce less or move into some other activity. Paying over the market clearing price will do just what the EU CAP does, which is to encourage overproduction. It encourages surpluses and it encourages dependence on subsidy. I have to ask, as a Catholic, why my church from time to time advocates these policies. Bad advice is given to developing countries by well-meaning church groups about tariffs and free trade. Church groups, for example, often seem to think tariffs are like a saint's relic, which will protect poor countries in some magical way from developed countries and the evils of the market. In fact, nearly all countries are largest trading partners of their neighbours, and so tariffs in Africa are, for example, an example of just beggar my neighbour activities. So I think very strongly, and it's the reason why I represent the party I do, that there is a difference between socialism and social action. The modern church, for political reasons, often quotes in a misleading way some of the doctors of the church. Saint Augustine is a frequent victim. I often see it in the way Pope Leo XIII's Rerum Novarum is misquoted, a great encyclical by a great pope. That pope was concerned with protection of the weak and the poor through the pursuit of justice. But he was concerned at doing so while excluding socialism and class struggle as legitimate principles of change. He said, and I quote, "When men know they are working on what belongs to them, they work with far greater eagerness and diligence. Nay, in a word, they learn to love the land cultivated by their own hands, whence they look not only for food, but for some measure of abundance for themselves and their dependents." That was not written by someone from the Chicago school, it was written by Leo XIII. Rerum Novarum is not an invitation to socialism or social democracy. It is a document affirming the dignity of work and the right to private property. Think of the third temptation of Christ. Christ was offered earthly dominion. All he had to do was worship Satan. Think what a better place the world would be if Christ did have earthly dominion. No war, no starvation, and we'd all have the moral status of cattle. The churches, by intervening in social policy, have fallen for the third temptation, and in return are paying the price by becoming too politically oriented. Some of the time, the church's positions on social matters are less about principle and more about allowing self-promotion by various individuals within the church. I sometimes see this in my own work at Parliament. The bishop's statement on the Foreshore and Seabed Act was a very poor piece of work. This is the state of things, is all the more disappointing when one considers the rich economic history of the church. Let me give you an example from the 16th and 17th centuries, and I refer to the late scholastics, Catholic theologians, sometimes Spanish, who came nearer than any other group to having been the founders of scientific economics. In the 19th and 20th centuries, theologians often advocated the setting of just prices by the public authority and recommended the guild system as a vehicle for promoting justice for buyers and sellers. It turns out the scholastics were right on that point. They chided the guilds for their monopolistic behaviour. The scholastics of Salamanca worked out marginal utility, that the just price of something is what it is worth to the purchaser. According to Louis de Molina, who was born in 1535 and died in 1600, an employed was only obliged to pay someone the just wage for his services, considering all the attendant circumstances, not what is sufficient for his sustenance and much less for the maintenance of his children and family. Domingo de Soto argued that if they freely accepted the salary for their job, it must be just, and said that no injury is done to those who gave their consent. His advice to unhappy employees was simple. If you don't want to work for that salary, leave. Again, these from the scholastics of Spain. It's hard to imagine those kinds of views being put forward by some of today's churches. Free market ideas, at least in inchoate form, long preceded the Enlightenment. They originated at least partially in the church. They are traditions of the church in this area, and they are traditions which should be debated because they go toward informing our economic policy. They're very important, and let me emphasize to you that vague notions of social justice and fairness, which involve a powerful, all-knowing, and all-giving state, whose justification is only possible, in my view, through a fundamental misreading of Scripture, are to be rejected by those among us who are sensible.